Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we are again for the 120th time on Capital Week. Who would have thought that? Welcome.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Last week, Laura, as everybody who was listening knows, you were suffering and really suffering from the coronavirus, and you came on the program anyway. How are you feeling tonight?
Feeling much better this week. It's mostly passed. It's just the very tail end of a cold is how I feel right now.
Well, good luck. We've got 30 minutes to talk, and I know you're going to be here. It's always good to have you here, even when you're under the weather, as you have been a couple of times in the course of this broadcast. But you're a heroine. You are. I get a splinter, I'm out. That's it. All right. We have, as always, plenty to hash out on this broadcast. And we're going to start with the biggest political story of this past weekend in Iowa. What was billed as, but didn't turn out to be, the appearance of both former President Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Both were scheduled to be in Iowa to fire up their troops for the GOP caucuses next year. But Laura, all that wild weather on Saturday, tornado watches, tornado warnings, rain, prompted Trump to cancel his scheduled outdoor rally in Des Moines. But DeSantis came to Iowa, and he made an unscheduled stop in Des Moines. Let's start with Trump. What happened there?
Well, I saw some people throwing some shade at Donald Trump and saying, really, the weather was beautiful. There was rain early in the day on Saturday, but not later when Trump canceled the flight. And there was some speculation that maybe he was canceling the rally that was supposed to be at Des Moines Waterworks Park because the crowd size wasn't building to what was anticipated. I will say that the waterworks is a very low-lying area and the ground can get saturated. And I heard from people who were out there scheduled to cover the rally that the ground was quite wet. So I can understand why they canceled. I don't know. I mean, there were tornado watches. The weather wasn't really that wild. I don't know exactly about the flight and whether it was absolutely necessary for Donald Trump's plane to cancel the flight. But in any case, he'll be back. And I'm sure that he'll have a large rally somewhere when he is back.
His appearance in Iowa on Saturday night would have come 4 days after that Manhattan jury found him liable in a civil case for sexual abuse and defamation. It did not stop him from going on CNN after that and completely disavowing any knowledge of the woman who accused him, as well as lying as he did. And that's just the way it was. That's the only thing you can say about virtually everything involving what happened in the 2020 election. He did that on CNN, and that was all since our last show.
Yes, and I saw some legal experts saying that it's possible that he opened himself up to yet another defamation lawsuit from E. Jean Carroll based on what he said about her on that CNN town hall. But I'll tell you that Iowa Republicans sure aren't in a hurry to comment on that verdict. And when Governor Kim Reynolds was on Iowa Press, the Iowa Public Television show on Friday, she was asked about it. And she said she wanted to talk about what's happening at the border and the Biden immigration policy and fentanyl coming in over the border. Basically, she was not interested in talking about this situation involving Donald Trump. So I think that we're not going to hear a lot of the other candidates talk about it either if they can get away with it.
Trump's appearance on CNN generated its own controversy even before he got there. There were many who said he should not be allowed live airtime to discuss anything because he will lie. And yet here you have a presidential candidate, the leading candidate by every poll for the Republican nomination. It's difficult to say this man should not be on live television unless you're willing to say nobody should be on live television.
Well, I think the media criticism of it, what I found more persuasive was it wasn't just that they gave Donald Trump a live forum, but they handpicked an audience of basically Trump supporters. And then ahead of time, according to some people who were in the room, CNN executives came out and told the crowd that it was okay for them to applaud, but discouraged them from booing. So it was almost that they set things up so that Trump would have a laugh track or an audience approval track for almost anything that he said during the town hall. And that's not really, if you're going to have a town hall, you might want to have an audience of undecided voters in New Hampshire or something along those lines, rather than having a room full of people who are inclined to support Donald Trump. So I think journalistically, that side of it was questionable. And I saw an interesting analysis of Ron DeSantis. Of course, he's trying to draw a lot of contrast between himself and Donald Trump and saying we need to look forward and not backward. But journalists are not able to get a straight answer out of him when they ask, did Donald Trump lose the 2020 election? That's a question that he doesn't really want to answer either.
Well, we can both answer that. The answer is yes, he did. By every judicial decision, by every metric, yes, Mr. Trump lost the election. All right. Well, he
did
not.
It actually wasn't even that close an election. I mean, the 2012 election, which Mitt Romney lost, was much closer in terms of the popular vote and the Electoral College vote.
And while Mr. Trump did not come to Iowa, the Florida governor did indeed. And he actually went out of his way to show up Mr. Trump. I'll give the overview and then you get into the specifics. His impression was so good to the New York Times, which wrote the story the next day. They praised what DeSantis did in Iowa on Saturday, said maybe he's gotten his footing now. Take it from there.
I've been following Iowa caucus campaigns for a long time. And for Ron DeSantis to come out and have 37 endorsements from Iowa legislators, that is really unheard of. I went back and looked at the endorsements of presidential candidates prior to the last three competitive Republican caucuses. And before 2008, and this is on the eve of the 2008 caucuses, the person with the most endorsements had 16. That was Mitt Romney at that time. Going into the 2012 caucuses, the most endorsements, that was 10. And going into the 2016 caucuses, Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, who ended up winning the Iowa caucuses that year, he had a dozen endorsements. So Ron DeSantis already has more than three dozen, and they include some of the most senior members of the legislature, the second ranking Republicans in both the Iowa House and Iowa Senate, and people really across the spectrum. I mean, some very well-known social conservatives like Skylar Wheeler up in the northwest part of the state, and also some of the more moderate members of the caucus, Brent Segrist in Council Bluffs. So I felt that Ron DeSantis took a big step this weekend toward making this a two-person race for the Republican nomination, and that's job one for him, instead of being one among many people challenging Donald Trump, setting himself up as the main alternative to Trump.
DeSantis never mentioned Trump by name, but he said, again in his words, the time for excuses is over. We've got to demonstrate the courage to lead and the strength to win, clearly aiming at Donald Trump, who's completely in retrospect, talking about retrospect. Oh, the election was stolen. Everybody's stupid if they don't understand that. That is not where Ron DeSantis is right now.
No, and he repeatedly talks about moving forward, accomplishments. His endorsers, including the House Majority Leader in Iowa, Matt Winchell, he said, we need someone looking forward. The Iowa Senate President, Amy Sinclair, said the same kind of thing, that she appreciates what Donald Trump did as president, but we've got to have somebody who can take the country forward. So this is clearly a mantra we're going to hear a lot from the DeSantis camp over the next 7 or 8 months.
And here was a really interesting step. DeSantis was scheduled, as you know, for two appearances, one in Sioux Center, one in Cedar Rapids. But then when his campaign found out that Trump had canceled in Des Moines, what does Ron DeSantis do? He comes to Des Moines.
That's right. And he did a really quick stop. I mean, I think he was only at the Jethro's restaurant for about 15 to 20 minutes, but he made his point. He spoke to a crowd of people. He has a big crowd of reporters following him around, and he got the footage that he wanted of people in Des Moines very interested in hearing from him. Now, again, Donald Trump's rallies are going to most likely be quite a bit bigger than DeSantis. I think DeSantis spoke to a crowd of about 700 people in Sioux Center. I mean, that's a large rally by Iowa standards. It's probably not as large as what Donald Trump can command. And we still have yet to see whether Ron DeSantis can rally the rank and file. But again, I think that what happened this weekend, if you're a Republican who's considering somebody other than Donald Trump, this weekend really makes you think, this guy, this governor of Florida, is probably my main alternative.
Every poll shows that Trump is leading. DeSantis is second. DeSantis has not yet announced he's running, but he's scheduled to do that anytime, perhaps even as soon as this week. But others came to Iowa last week as well. One of them, Vivek Ramaswamy, whom almost nobody knows, and he made news by saying he supports raising the minimum U.S. voting age from 18 to 25. And that's not going to happen. He also said some other things like kids should only be allowed to vote if they take part in a national service requirement. He knows that's not going to happen.
This is what I would call a gimmick that long shot presidential candidates do of both parties. I mean, they try to get some attention, get some earned media coverage by saying something different than what you're hearing from the rest of the field. And he did. He got some coverage of it. But Vivek Ramaswamy, I see him as somebody who's running, not really running for president, but running for a job in the next Republican administration. I mean, it's just hard for me to imagine any scenario where he puts together a winning campaign. However, he does seem to be favorably received by audiences. And I had to laugh when he was talking about raising the voting age. He was speaking before an audience that was predominantly older voters, as most Iowa caucus events do draw predominantly people over age 45 or 50. There were probably a lot of people there who were old enough to remember when the voting age was lowered from 21 to 18. So again, this is, like you said, it's not going to happen. Passing a federal constitutional amendment is incredibly difficult, and it's just hard to see any states really ratifying this raise the voting age. But it was something that got him some press.
Yeah, it would take two-thirds a vote in both houses of Congress, and then three-quarters of all the states would have to agree with this. If anybody believes that's going to happen, I have some land in Midtown Manhattan I'd like to sell you.
That's right. Exactly.
Another presidential candidate came to town. Believe it or not, his name is Ryan Binkley of Texas. Yes, he's a Republican businessman. He said he had heard calls from the Lord about what's needed in our country. Therefore, he's running.
I mean, look, this is like we've discussed Perry Johnson before. I mean, a lot of people who are successful in other areas of life decide they want to run for president. It's kind of a vanity project for them. But I can't imagine that there's going to be oxygen in the room for a candidate like that. I mean, you've got two heavyweights, Trump with a massive reservoir of support among rank and file Republicans. Then you have Ron DeSantis, who's going to have a really well-funded campaign, probably tens of millions of dollars. I mean, it's just hard to see how there's a lane for anybody like this Ryan Binkley.
That may be the only time we mention his name on this broadcast, so I'll say it one more time, Ryan Binkley.
Yes, if he even makes it to the Republican televised debates. I mean, it's not clear how they're going to be doing the debates, but on the Democratic side, last time they had a threshold where candidates had to reach a certain polling threshold to even be included in the televised debate. So that's probably going to weed out candidates like this one.
Two other candidates who are fighting for oxygen, Nikki Haley, former UN ambassador, and former Vice President Mike Pence. Hard to see what their avenue is to the nomination, but they're coming to Iowa as well.
Yes, Senator Joni Ernst has an annual Roast and Ride fundraiser, and she often invites prominent people from around the country, and Nikki Haley and Mike Pence are going to be there. But again, there are only 98 Republicans now serving in the Iowa legislature, and 55 of them have already committed to either Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis. So this is going to be really difficult. I mean, I don't know how, if you're Nikki Haley, that's her line is that we need to be looking forward. We need to let a new generation of leadership. And that's basically Ron DeSantis's line only. And she is also a former governor, but I think that he has a recent record of accomplishment that is something Republican audiences are looking at. He's been dealing with a lot of the same issues that the Iowa legislature has been dealing with. And I think that his stump speech is likely to resonate more naturally with a lot of Iowa Republicans compared to Nikki Haley's. And I don't really know who the Mike Pence constituency is supposed to be.
I think that's difficult to see. Yes, I agree with you. All right, one more note on the national level before we get down back to Iowa. Iowa Republican 3rd District Congressman Zach Nunn saying he would introduce legislation to remove Social Security, Medicare, and veterans benefits from federal debt ceiling discussions. As you know, as we go on the air live on this Monday night, there's no agreement on raising the debt limit. There could be a default. It would be potentially catastrophic. Nunn, at least taking the steps to say, let's remove these things because this would be catastrophic, losing Social Security or Medicare for older people.
Well, this is interesting to me because all of the four Republicans who serve in the Iowa House voted last month for that bill that was passed that was called the debt ceiling bill that called for certain budget cuts. And it did say that Social Security and Medicare would be shielded, but it didn't specifically say that veterans benefits would be shielded. And so the Biden administration has been out there saying, if this thing were enacted, which of course it won't be, the Democratic-controlled Senate will never pass this, but if it were, it would lead to pretty big cuts in veterans benefits. So I sensed when I heard this announcement from Zach Nunn last week that maybe he's a little bit worried. Of course, he served in the military himself, and he's a little bit worried. He doesn't want to be associated with any potential cuts to veterans benefits. But it gets pretty hard when you start X-ing out things that the federal government has to keep paying. I mean, if we go into default sometime in June and we just don't have, the federal government doesn't have the money to pay its outstanding obligations, it's hard to see how long you can continue to shield things like Social Security, Medicare, and veterans benefits. Of course, there are lots of other things people rely on, federal food assistance, farm subsidies that wouldn't be halted or that wouldn't be shielded during this kind of an outcome.
It is 15 minutes after the hour. Wherever you're listening to us, this is KHY's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source, that's who we are, for everything political going on in Iowa. We are here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and to talk about Ryan Binkley, Mike Pence, Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Ryan Binkley, and what it all means. I had to say it because we may never say it again.
It's true.
It's not making fun of Mr. Binkley. We are happy you're in the race. All right. Last week, briefly, Governor Reynolds praised the legislature, and this is not a surprise. She got virtually everything she wanted. She said things are going very well in the state. She's excited about what's happening and excited about our future. They gave her a lot of victories, but she's not done. She's going to address a couple of biggies next year that she really wants to have.
Yes. And I want to mention, first of all, because a number of readers have asked me what's going on with this, that, or the other bill that the governor hasn't signed yet. When the legislature adjourns, the governor has 30 days to either sign or veto bills that are sent to her within those last few days of the legislative session. So that's why there are a number of major bills we've talked about on past shows, the education bills, the cuts to food assistance and Medicaid, and other things that the state auditor bill that the governor hasn't signed yet. I still do anticipate that she will sign all of those bills, but that's why you haven't heard that she's signed them. In any case, yes, as you said, I mean, what's not to like if you're Kim Reynolds? She got, in addition to everything that she mentioned, pretty much in her condition of the state speech, other than the more support for moms funding. That was about the only thing she highlighted in that speech that she didn't get. And her own office got a budget allocation increase of more than 20%, even though most state agencies were stuck on status quo budget. So she really did get everything she wanted. During this appearance on the Iowa Press TV program, she did say that she wants to address public school teacher salaries. And this, you can, some people call it over the counter. It's more accurate to call it behind the counter birth control, because it would be something that pharmacists could dispense without a physician's prescription. They've passed it twice in the Senate. It hasn't gotten through the Iowa House yet. And it's something that the governor says she's going to keep working on. I mean, again, I question how much of a priority it really is, because when something is a priority for the governor, she really works hard to line up the support in both chambers to pass it. And I never got any inkling during this session that she was leaning on any members of the Iowa House to get this to her desk.
She didn't run into a lot of headwinds in the legislature, but she did last week. She was sued for refusing to pay pandemic-related jobless assistance to 30,000 Iowans.
This was fascinating. So this is two Iowans filed the lawsuit. They're seeking class action status, and potentially at least 30,000 people could qualify. You may remember we discussed this way back in 2021, almost exactly 2 years ago. The governor announced that Iowa was going to end its participation in some pandemic-related unemployment enhancements 3 months early. These were scheduled to run until about Labor Day of 2021, and Iowa ended its participation in June of that year. And so that meant that 30,000 people, or perhaps more according to some estimates, they were still able to get their regular unemployment, but they were losing that extra federal assistance that was provided during the pandemic. And that was hundreds of dollars a week for a number of people. So this lawsuit argues that it was a violation of federal law and the federal constitution because it was a taking of people's property without due process. And then this was interesting to me. It also argues that there is a state law that says that Iowa Workforce Development, the agency, that they shall ensure that Iowans collect all the unemployment benefits to which they're entitled. And so they're arguing that the Reynolds administration violated this state law. Now, this kind of litigation can take years to play out, but I'm going to be watching this one very closely. I thought it was quite interesting.
All right. There was an interesting state Supreme Court decision on transgender law, and we want to be very clear on this. We know that the state legislature this past session passed a bill that the governor signed or will sign banning transgender gender-affirming care for students, kids under the age of 18. This is different. This decision involves the state banning Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming surgery. Let's talk about that.
This goes way back. This is really the first action of the Iowa legislature under the Republican trifecta to target medical care to transgender Iowans. And this happened on the last day of the 2019 legislative session. There was an amendment to the Health and Human Services budget that said that Medicaid, it didn't actually say that it should be a ban on Medicaid coverage, but it did say that programs, state-funded healthcare programs, can't be required to cover this kind of gender-affirming surgery. It was a response to an Iowa Supreme Court ruling that had come down in March of 2019 that said that the state policy, the longstanding state policy denying Medicaid coverage for those surgeries, was a violation of the Iowa Civil Rights Act. So the legislature responded. They passed this carve-out to the Iowa Civil Rights Act, and two transgender Iowans on Medicaid, represented by the ACLU of Iowa, filed this lawsuit, and it took a really long time to work its way through the courts. But in 2021, a Polk County District Court agreed with the plaintiffs and struck down this law. And so this is what went to the Iowa Supreme Court. And what they decided last week was a little bit of it was a big question mark, because they basically sidestepped the constitutional issue. They said this case is moot because Iowa Medicaid, the Department of Human Services, has agreed to cover the surgeries for these two plaintiffs. So there's no longer a live controversy. So that leaves open the question of how the Iowa Supreme Court might approach some future case related to a legislative ban on certain types of medical care for transgender people. I do still expect that this law passed this year that banned gender-affirming care, including surgery, for Iowans under age 18. I do expect that to be challenged in court. I think it's more likely that a federal lawsuit will be filed rather than something that in the state courts that would reach the Iowa Supreme Court. But in any case, the upshot is that Iowans on Medicaid right now can receive these kind of gender-affirming surgeries because the state has decided not to enforce that policy. But we don't know whether the Iowa Supreme Court considers that law constitutional or unconstitutional, because they said they didn't need to decide that yet.
Now, before making that decision, the court had made another decision on the right to sue. A bottom line is that 6 years after ruling that Iowans could bring a lawsuit against the state or violations of their state constitutional rights, the Supreme Court has reversed itself.
Yes, this was a very big deal. So in 2017, and the Iowa Supreme Court was quite different then. Remember that Governor Reynolds has appointed 5 out of the 7 justices. But there was an important ruling in a case called Godfrey. It was named after Chris Godfrey, the former Iowa Workers' Compensation Commissioner, who had sued the Branstad administration. And it was an important 4-3 decision that said that Iowans could bring certain types of constitutional claims against the state over violations of their rights. And this is something that, again, 3 justices at the time dissented from that ruling. 2 of them are still serving on the court, joined by 5 appointees of Governor Reynolds. And this is very important that they reverse this precedent, because this affects a lot of other cases in the interim. In the meantime, have been brought by people charging that whether it's law enforcement or other types of state officials have violated their constitutional rights. And now the hurdle for those plaintiffs has just gotten a lot higher, because the Iowa Supreme Court is now saying that unless the legislature has specifically said you can sue over this kind of a constitutional violation, that these types of lawsuits are going to be thrown out.
So basically, since the legislature probably hasn't made a lot of those decisions about who can sue and what can be sued over, these types of lawsuits may go away, just go away.
Well, they may. Some of them may. I mean, we'll have to see. There are a lot of attorneys who work in this area, and in some cases, they may be able to file under federal courts. But after this Godfrey decision, and then even further in 2018, there was a decision following from that that was also 4-3 that was called the Baldwin case that was even more protective of Iowans trying to sue over violations of their constitutional rights. I think there was a trend toward bringing this type of case in state court because the atmosphere was seen to be more favorable. Now, with this latest ruling, the case is called Burnett, that overturned this Godfrey precedent and by extension really eliminated a lot of the heart of this Baldwin case. I think that we are probably going to see fewer of these lawsuits in state court, but there still are claims. People can still bring certain types of constitutional claims in state court. And I think that you'll probably still see some of these lawsuits attempted.
A couple of more quickies before we run out of time. A district court decision, a big one, involved eminent domain. A court decided that the Iowa law letting hazardous liquid pipeline companies access private land for surveys is unconstitutional. That is potentially a very big one.
This is very interesting. This was a case coming out of Clay County, and there is a very similar lawsuit. This is the Navigator CO2 Ventures. This is one of the three companies seeking to build a pipeline in Iowa. And they've sued a number of landowners, and this was one of the cases because the landowners didn't provide them access to do these surveys when they're trying to figure out the exact route for their pipeline. And I found this very interesting because this is a great example of unintended consequences, I would say, that there were similar lawsuits when Iowa was considering the Dakota Access Pipeline during the 2010s. And these lawsuits were the landowners were not successful in barring the surveyors from their land. But in the intervening years, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case in 2021 that was over a California regulation related to labor unions. California said basically that landowners have to allow labor unions to send their representatives onto your land to talk to your migrant workers about possibly forming a union or joining a union. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 6-3 majority, the conservative justices, said that this is an unconstitutional taking of someone's property, even if it's just somebody temporarily being on your property and not inflicting any permanent damage. They said this is a taking of property. And that's what this Clay County District Court judge in Iowa cited in this order. He said, when these landowners are told that they have to let somebody from Navigator or another company on their land to survey the land, that is an unconstitutional taking of their property. And the Navigator says it's going to appeal this ruling. We still don't have a ruling in a very similar case out of Woodbury County, but it's going to be interesting because I'm sure this is destined to reach the Iowa Supreme Court, and they've had some mixed rulings when it comes to property rights. So we'll see how they resolve this. But the Iowa Constitution does have some fairly strong language protecting property rights. And the question is, will the Iowa Supreme Court see this issue the same way as the U.S. Supreme Court and say, letting somebody temporarily on your land is a taking of your property?
90 seconds and we can do it here. The U.S. Supreme Court, speaking of them, rejected last week an Iowa-based farm group's challenge to a California animal cruelty law, not credulity, as I wrote on the script here, that imposes requirements on the sale of pork products that Midwestern farmers say could upend their industry. This is a big one for pork producers in the Midwest. There's no question about that.
It is. And people were very upset. Iowa officials across the board were very upset about this ruling. And it was a splintered ruling. It was written actually by a conservative justice, Gorsuch. It was a decision that five justices joined in part. But in any case, the upshot was that they said, this is not a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause for the state of California to have these regulations. And they basically said that pork producers in other states, if they can decide to do whatever they want, if they just decide not to sell their products in the state of California. Of course, that's difficult with California being such a large population state and having such a large share of the economy.
At issue was a 2018 ballot measure known as Prop 12 out here in California that banned the sale of pork unless the sow from which the butchered pig was born was housed in a pen with at least 24 square feet of floor space. And that is not the standard practice in the industry.
No, it isn't. And it's something that the Iowa producers, the pork producers who challenged this, they said that this is going to be expensive for them to comply with. But really, I mean, the court dismissed the lawsuit. So they've got two options, either comply with this or choose not to sell their products in the state of California.
Joni Ernst said in an interesting tweet, California should not be allowed to, and these are all caps now, ban our bacon. Well, I don't know if they're banning our bacon, but that's the law of the land now.
I mean, they're not really banning. I mean, they're saying that if you want to sell your bacon in California, it has to be raised. The pigs have to be raised in a certain way. And the Justice Kavanaugh, in a partial concurrence, he raised a question that how many other laws or ballot initiatives are we going to see in other states where either liberal or conservative, where states try to impose their values on the entire country? And this could be opening a can of worms.
We are out of time. Laura, see you next week.
See you next week, Dennis.
A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff or of Ryan Binkley. Laura and I will both be back next Monday night at 7 when we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style. Until then, you have a safe, healthy, and happy week.